Welcome to another episode of AEC Perspectives. I'm your host, Brian Nickel, Chief Strategy Officer for RSNH. And today I'm thrilled to have RSNH's National Design Director, Philip Robbie, back on the podcast. And this time he's joined with our first external guest, Andrew Chin, the Associate Professor at the Florida A&M University School of Architecture, Engineering, and Technology. Andrew has a Bachelor of Design and Master of Architecture from the University of Florida and a Master of Science in Urban and Regional Planning from Florida State University. Andrew's been teaching design studios, thesis research, and urban design classes at the University of Florida, Georgia Institute of Technology, and FAMU since 1991. His community design assistance with the support of agencies like the Florida Department of Community Affairs and the Florida Division of Historical Resources exposes the intersection of race and urban form in North Florida. Philip has a Bachelor of Architecture from Kent State University. He has 30 years of international experience in all areas of architectural practice, including master planning, programming, space planning, interior design, and architectural design. Philip's work has gained recognition in the profession through numerous AIA design awards and as a visiting guest lecturer, and has been featured in professional publications. Philip has a diverse background in the demanding markets of higher education, aviation, healthcare, and corporate clients. In the United States, there are approximately 120,000 architects who hold active licenses, which may seem like a relatively small number, considering our country's population is around 331 million people. This translates to roughly 0.04% of our population being architects, meaning that 99% of people live and work in spaces created by the 1% of licensed architects. Today, I'm excited to discuss what this means for those taking the first steps towards a career as an architect, students, and what we as an industry can do to retain top talent. Welcome to the podcast, Andrew and Philip.
Great, great. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, let's just lay the foundation. And Andrew, I want to start with you. Can you give a brief overview of what schooling and or experiences required to become an architect? Let's just start at the foundation.
Sure. The foundation, I mean, it's an accredited degree. So 9 out of 10 states in the process, and let's say just speak really in general, you need to have an accredited degree. And there are different paths students can follow, either the professional bachelor's degree, typically 5 years, or professional master's degree, typically 4+2. Now, there are other options that are in there. There's a 5-year master's at some place and a 3.5-year master's if you have another degree. But really, the key point is an accredited degree from the National Architecture Accreditation Board, also referred to as NAB. So do you have a NAB accredited degree? And there are more than 100 options across the U.S.
Well, that's an incredible sort of dynamic situation where you have a number of different pathways to become an architect. Is there one pathway that you initially lead students down?
No, I think as you stated, I think students have many options, and it will really, they need to look at what are the options in their state if they're going to stay at school at home, or what are the options at the schools they plan on going to. But different schools are, let's say, permitted by their state for certain degree options. So often the universities don't have a choice, but there are a lot of options out there for students. If your first degree is not in architecture, well, you can still get a master's degree accredited in architecture at many places for either 3 or 3.5 years. And that's actually the first step. Step one is the degree. Step two is the internship hours or AXP. And step three is the exam.
And so it takes all of those steps to ultimately become that licensed architect.
Yeah, nine out of 10, it's steps one, two, and three. There are unique options, unique paths, but I think what we say generally, it's one, two, and step three.
What should someone expect to study as an architecture student? Give us a kind of a capsule of what to expect.
Yeah, all accredited programs have to meet certain experiences for their students. So within that content, most graduates will say, hey, I spent 50, 60, 75% of my time focused on design studio. And design studio, your architecture design studio, is that component, that piece, I think, that really differentiates the architecture student experience from, let's say, an engineering student's experience. But so balanced with the majority of your time being in design studio will be a history sequence, structures classes, materials and methods, environmental systems, and even professional practice, in addition to general education, math, physics, and all those other kind of components. So all accredited architecture degrees have a balance of general education plus architecture-specific classes. And those architecture-specific classes, everyone knows who graduates. They'll say, I spent all my time on studio, and then I tried to fit in everything else.
Well, that's a unique aspect of going through an architectural schooling. Philip, I know we're heavily interested at RSNH in attracting those students into our firm so that we can grow them as architects, help them on their pathway to licensure. Talk about how you look at students and what's important from your perspective.
First thing I would suggest is all practicing architects and businesses in architecture reach back to the colleges and universities and be part of them and support them. We try to do our little pop-up studios. We try to, it helps us to be part of juries, to be part of, you know, be part and support your local universities and colleges and universities. And certainly, you know, historic Black colleges and universities, go there, be part of the juries, you know. And what happens is you begin to connect with the students, and each school of architecture is different. You know, they all have a different emphasis, and you begin to harmonize with that school, realize, you know, what is the school looking to do and impart upon its students. And when you're in the juries and you're talking to the students and you're visiting the schools, you begin to harmonize with them, and you begin to see, you know, what are these students like, you know, and what is that university really imparting upon them. So have that connection early on, and then what happens is you'll find that there's some students that you kind of connect with. There's some that really resonate with what it is that you are bringing to that university. And before they graduate, you begin to recognize and harmonize with those students. Then as they get attracted to your firm or to your studios or what you're working on, it's easier for them, and they want to, look, you want to demystify the profession. And I think Andrew said that, you know, some of their students have never really, you know, talked to an architect or been part of an architectural project. Demystifying that is like the first step, and it really helps them along their career paths. Then the internships are really important. Bring them into the practice, make them part of it and part of that studio. It really helps them. And they get, you know, they get paid for it. They begin to work with other design professionals in your firm, and they really begin to understand what the profession's really like. Those internships are really important, helps them move along their path, gives them some of that crucial funding. You know, I mean, it's really, you know, these are expensive professions. So I think it's really important to reach out to the universities, be part of the universities, support them, hire interns, bring them into your firm, and bring them into the design studio. Every student has different challenges. I think, like in our strategy group, we're all remote. We work remote, and there's different challenges to that. The young architects that have come from FAMU to our uh, to to my personal group have really understood that, been able to manage their time, been able to understand the technology and the connect in that remote environment. So, you know, those are some of the, you know, the low hanging fruit there.
I think you hit right on it. I think a lot of the misconception is people are going to architecture school to learn style or to learn how to design a thing, but it's actually learning how to work with other people, as Phil said, to be responsible, to show up on time, to follow through, to be creative animals and to be disciplined and kind of take, you know, being able to ask questions when you don't know something. But, you know, I say over and over again, you know, people, you can learn software. You can learn software, but some people just, you can't learn how to be nice next to the person you sit next to 5 days a week for 8 hours a day. So I think it's a lot of the soft skills is what RSNH's industry is looking for. So I think architecture programs like, you know, Florida A&M, we try to focus on building the whole student.
And that complete student is so critical. You know, I was stunned as I was preparing for the podcast to learn that there were only just over 120,000 architects across the country. What do you think in terms of students maybe not pursuing a path to licensure? What are you seeing about that at Florida A&M? And what is the challenge for the future?
There are multiple accredited programs in the state of Florida, so there are many different options, priorities, and perspectives. So, and I think, you know, they all should mimic each other. They all have different priorities. At our school of Florida A&M, we recognize the responsibility to produce licensed architects. So, you know, year one freshman class, you need to spend a day on a field trip. We go to a major, we take them to a major city. You need to visit three different offices, meet architects, and at least get a glimpse into what is possible. And if we don't start off by letting them know what it takes to be licensed, we need to at least set that clearly as one of their goals and objectives. At our place, it is a goal. It's an objective. It's how we measure our success. So I think, first of all, you know, schools need to recognize that as part of their outcome. But two, it's also providing a fair and honest picture into their potential futures. And I say plural because I think many students think that, oh, if I get my degree in architecture and get licensed, I'm going to do this one thing as a licensed architect, and realize, no, there's space for all kinds of skill sets in an office. When you look at RSNH, there's a lot of different people with different skill sets saying they're an architect. And we need to kind of be real clear about, hey, you're good at A, you fit. B, you fit. You're good at C, D, E, and F. You have a future here too. You value. So really kind of helping students see the broad possibilities within the discipline with their license.
And in fact, Philip, I know that's exactly how you look at these students. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It's a big profession. It is a huge profession. And when we have individuals that graduate from the School of Architecture, and there's some of them that are really technical. They know how to put a building together. They know how to put documents together. Others, you know, the politician, you know, we need those people that can speak up, that go to school board meetings, to go to city council meetings, that are active at that political front and are able to protect our profession and make sure that the laws and regulations that are coming out, you know, are not doing damage to the profession of architecture. We need the politicians. We need the people that are the spec writers. We need the businessmen, the ones that can go in and negotiate a fee and walk. You know, the likelihood of being profitable on your project starts with that individual that can go down, sit at the table and negotiate a fair fee. Oh, my goodness. You know, those people are so important. So, you know, sometimes they may not be the best designer in the school, but boy, you know, if they have those other abilities, they're really valuable to the profession. And, you know, so we need that diversity in those skill sets because it's expected in our profession. And businesses like ourselves, you know, open your doors. You know, when Andrew comes to town with all of these students, make yourself available. Let them come into your firm. Show them how you work and what you do and that, you know, there's a space for everybody. So make yourself available. Support the schools of architecture. And every school of architecture is different. they emphasize different things and understand that there's diversity in these schools. We have 77 locations in continental United States. 26 of them are design offices. Each of our offices through Dallas and Denver and Houston and, you know, up through Chicago. And, you know, that message, you know, my position is broad ranging across all of the offices. So I need to impart upon all of these offices to open their doors and make them available to the schools and the universities. And you're right, 120,000 architects in continental United States. I really need to impart upon our young architects and all of our architects that there's a social responsibility. You know, you are the voice of 350 million people in continental United States. So, you know, our studios need to be as diverse as our population is, you know, so that we truly understand those people we represent, you know. And when you are in a meeting and all of a sudden the discussion begins to go towards the fastest, cheapest building, you know, there's a moment there where there's a moment of silence. You have to have the courage, you know, to stand up and say, I understand budget, I understand schedule, but I also understand the social responsibilities, and to be able to engage in that discussion. Don't be afraid. You know, you don't want to that evening regret the fact you didn't speak up. So, you know, we really have to teach people how to speak up respectfully, how to engage in that conversation.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about sort of this almost an endangered profession in the sense that what we want to do is build on those 120,000 architects. And when we see the statistics that say only 25 to as much as 40% of graduating architects actually become licensed, that says to me that there is great room for improvement in pushing that number higher, because I know it's really nice to hear that the university has that focus to have licensure, because that's a focus in industry and in business. And so at RSNH, we have the same desire to have architects become licensed and to do it in a way that can offer all kinds of skill sets. Can you talk about the kind of skill sets that you see in today's students, what their interest is, Andrew?
Yeah, well, I think the students have often changed, but there's, I think, some things that stay the same, whether you were a student like myself in the 80s or 90s, or as my son says, in the 1900s. So whether you were a student in the 1900s or not, you want to know that your current education that you're having has value. And the sooner you understand the value and potential of your current academic program, I think you'll put a lot more energy into it. A lot of the distractions that students have is because they're not sure they fit. They pick a major because it sounded really good. You know, I joke, you know, some 8-year-old kid who says, I want to be a quarterback for, you know, the Miami Dolphins or the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. I promise you, they've played football and they've been to a football game, right? But we got a lot of 18, 19-year-old people saying, I'm going to be an architect or engineer. And you ask them, have you ever met an architect or engineer? And a lot of them will say no. Have you ever been to an office? And they'll say, well, not really. My uncle or my aunt's an engineer, but they don't know anyone. So I think a lot of it is they're jumping into something. They don't know really a lot about that thing. They know it's respected, it's professional. They have an acumen for math and other communication skills, graphic, computers, and they pick a thing. So I think, one, it's important to help them understand the wide palette of options they'll have when they pick this thing, and be clear to them this is that your degree and other credentials are goals you need to set, and no one ever has too many credentials, right? The only people who say credentials don't matter are people who don't have credentials. So, right, you know, it's, I always say it's the opposite. People who have a whole lot of money say money doesn't matter. But nah, the people who don't have any money, they say, well, I wish I had some. But, you know, I think the students are the same. They need to know that there's value. And I agree with Phil. That's what the internships are so important, because the internships early on say, hey, what you're paying for and the time you're spending in school matters, can lead to something. So it gives students quickly that. I think the other part that is different about today's students is, as Phil said, they're less place-based. They are very comfortable on the screen talking like we're talking right now and not being in the same physical space. And while certain people, it's uncomfortable and it's not the same, it's just as good. For a lot, there are a lot more people on TikTok than meeting at a library and reading a book versus an online thing. And we got to ask ourselves, why? Why are they so comfortable doing video documentation and video? Why is that the safe space kind of for them? I think the other thing that I noticed that's significantly different is, in some ways, because of that autonomy, some of them are more self-directed. They don't want to pull out instructions and read through it. They're comfortable jumping into some things like software. And, you know, I think it's an old paradigm or structure where, okay, I have to go to this class to learn Revit, you know, and software and AutoCAD. And I'm like, kids today are not learning software and tools and apps by taking classes or reading instructions. They're just downloading that thing and jumping into it. And I'm curious how that's going to lead to a lot of good. I mean, people worry about the bad of, you know, downloading blah, 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 and it tears up your system. But I'm like, no. So if people aren't so scared and want to absorb and take advantage of these tools, that actually could be a good thing. It's less about formal training and more about immersion into a thing to control it, master it, and use it. So I think they're a little different, but some things are the same.
I just wanted to jump back a minute because, you know, you had asked the three skills that they recommend to develop. And I just wanted to add to that. There's the high tech, low tech, no tech. High tech skills, we always understand it. Learning new software, learning new tools, learning. And, you know, that's going to be a lifelong challenge. You know, and this high tech, low tech, no tech applies to me as it does as much to the interns that are graduating. So that high tech thing is crucial. We get it. We understand it. Keeping your edge, learning the technology. Low tech, you know, it's a strange little space that, you know, still needs to be embraced. The low tech skills of how to sketch, how to draw, how to annotate, you know, and how to build models, how to walk in with a model and break a part off and put a piece on and give it to the owner and let him hold it. The owner all of a sudden understands the top, the bottom, the back, and the sides simultaneously and can make a decision. Those low tech skills are crucial when you're in a room or in a space, whether it's virtual or physical, and, you know, this thing is heading off the tracks. You got to be able to pick up your iPad and sketch it right there. Say, no, you need to do this, this, and this. These are the reasons why we do this. The ability to stand up from the table and walk over to the marker board. And those couple of seconds, as you're walking to that marker board, you're getting that diagram in your head, and to take a cap off of a marker and sketch on the marker board. The clients get it and they see it, right? Those are those low tech skills. And then the no tech skills, I mean, to be able to connect with somebody in a charged environment when the lightning is going to strike, you know, to have the courage to stand up and say, you need to consider these things. We represent 99% of the population. These are the things that are important and should be in your project. To have the courage to stand up and say that is, and we train in our firm to give a voice to those interns. Not just to be an observer, you know, you can't say, I told you so. You have to stand up. You have to make a fuss. You have to voice yourself, your opinions. It's so crucial.
I agree 100%. Because even that other no tech, it's also the ability to listen and then pivot. Because when you talk about that person standing up, it's because they have to learn and have to have this ability to listen, hear, and kind of hear a gap and see, hey, wait a second, there's a gap going on. Person A isn't really understanding person B, and my boss And I maybe I can put in my two cents to help, you know, bridge this gap between what's going on. But as Phil said, having the guts to speak up, being able to listen and being able to either pivot what you're doing or listen in and help the team pivot to the when the things are changing around them. And it's interesting. That's that no tech skill, but it's just as valuable as the person who can, you know, click control, stop, blam, blam, and make the thing spin the way it's supposed to spin. And it's like seeing what's going on in front of you, and you see it, but other people don't even see it because they're not listening and they're so absorbed into what they're saying or what the boss is saying. They're not really thinking, looking across the room kind of panoramically and saying, what the heck's going on? And as Phil said, building that diagram in their head on the fly while the conversation's going on, and then you go low tech, pick up the pencil. And I always think that low tech is so, I think that's even gets to be more valuable today, because that is what that other person who can't draw can't do.
Yeah.
And it still is like magic. It's to up to most 9 out of 10 people, if you can draw something upside down or sketch that perspective, it's like magic. People, you know, they've seen VR. They've seen all kinds of stuff in AR and VR and whatever's next, MR. But you pick up that pencil and poof, like magic, it appears in front of them. That's something, you know.
And I'm going to say your students have those abilities. You know, I really appreciate that when
it's, you know, the joke is it's like when it's funny when we post analog stuff, students doing analog stuff on our social media, it gets the biggest reaction. So here's three, a young lady and she's welding. She has her welding gear on and she's welding. Everyone's like, wow. Before that, it was students using clay to mold a skull and they're drawing in charcoal, and that got huge. And then even a couple years ago, this guy from Jacksonville came in and did a watercolor workshop with a bunch of students. This guy from Jack, I can't remember his name, but but people are like, yeah, that's what architects, you know, because it's this other thing, this low tech, what Phil called labels is low tech skills and abilities. You know, sometimes I think schools got to find what separates them from the other schools. Mm-hmm. And if we pick, hey, that's what matters, being able, I call it right brain and left brain, you know, the tech stuff, and you can do both. You know, that's, it's balance. It's both. It's not just one. So yeah, I agree with Phil. It's high, low, and no, all the above.
You termed it the soft skills. And I think that those soft skills, that curiosity mindset that you bring to the problem, you talked about observe and then voice it. And both of you have connected on this listen and pivot, a connection with your clients or a connection to another architect or another teammate in the room. And those dynamics with that core architecture education, those are the things that really stand out, it seems like, in the workplace, in something you're teaching on a regular basis.
Yeah, I think so. And so, yeah, so I find a common, I don't know what to call it, nexus, spirit, affinity to people who are design studio centric design. And it's, I don't know what it is, but I think it's this ability to see and pivot and think on the fly and create and not get stuck in the problem, but focus on possibilities. I think you'll learn. I think architecture tries to teach that in studio. A lot of people get it in studio, and I think that's even more important than some of the isms you learn in studio. You know, it's this ability to think and shift and juggle three balls in your head at one time and not get distracted while someone else, you know, I think it's what people, I think it's what industry wants schools to teach and to, and not even teach, as you said, practice, drill, and just practice over and over again, versus the rhino or rabbit, you know, it's like, that doesn't matter. It's no, they want someone they can sit next to and someone who doesn't get stuck in the problem, but focuses on solutions and options. And I don't know, I don't think there's a formula or a cookbook to teach it, But I think I see a lot of people come out of places with that. So it's even when Phil's on our industry advisory board. And that's for me to put out outcome and for them to tell me, throw different things at me. And it's always I think it's an interesting conversation because schools are in their silos and their little circle. And they really don't know the other circle, but we know our kids are leaving our circle, going into my students are leaving my circle to Phil's circle, my silo to Phil's silo. And when they're in Phil's silo, there's a whole nother world going on in his silo. And I got to open up my silo occasionally to hear from his and figure out how do you think in both, but kind of be open to option, not focus on my problems, but get this group that's just brainstorming in front of me. And I think it's interesting to watch a dynamic at times. And that's what's exciting, interesting, whether it's a design problem or a problem of preparing students. That's why I like to have a lot of creative people around me.
Well, you're certainly in the right place. Every time I've been at FAMU, it's just the incredible creative process that I love walking through the studios and seeing how the professors are engaged. We're hungry for those kind of environments. And I really enjoy it.
Yeah, because those environments then help us solve problems for our clients and help us become solution providers. And so that well-rounded student that you're working on and developing over time, and then coming to us in an internship or coming to us as an entry-level young professional, we want that well-rounded architecture, the technical gravitas, but the curiosity and creative mindset. How challenging is it in today's world to create that kind of outcome at the university that translates to the business side?
I wish I knew the five steps to do that, because then it'd be a lot easier. A lot of people be working in Jacksonville and Fort Lauderdale with both you guys. But I don't think it's an easy answer. I think the formula is, or the pieces or the assumed steps are already there in terms of accreditation, that, hey, they need to balance general education and get out of the building and take calculus and physics with other normal non-architecture students. And you balance that with get in the building and take architecture classes, learn from a mix of active practitioners with non-active practice. Learn from a mix of people who are more engaged in practice and more engaged in academic practices. Learn from studio, where you kind of make and you cook the gumbo, versus structures class, M&M, and history and theory. And I think right now it's, hey, make sure they get a mix of all of those things, but make sure they're responsible, they show up on time, they understand that there's consequences if you don't do something, there's a reward if you put the time in. So in that way, I don't think it's different than a college of engineering or a college of music in terms of producing talented graduates. I think that's the stuff that stays the same. I think people get distracted by software. People get distracted by other discussions. And it's like, nah, man, let me tell you something. When it's a career fair, we out and out just ask the employers, what do you want? And no one will say, oh, they have to learn a certain piece of software. That's not what they say. They want good people, you know, people you can sit next to 5 days a week, and people who are good listeners and can think, you know.
There's so much, you know, to unpack in what you were just saying. My mind is like racing. You know, on the other side, when they cross that threshold and they enter in and they walk into our firm, I mean, the first thing, you know, from my perspective, when I'm working with the young graduates, is to really impart about them. You need to get licensed. You really need to get licensed. And it's an important step. And you need to do it as soon as possible. Don't wait 5, 6, 7, 8 years to start that process. You need to start today, because a lot of the stuff that's in the professional exams, you begin to forget, you know, take those exams, complete those sections, be aggressive in that, take as many sections as you possibly can. Our firm will support you. You know, we pay for those exams. We give you the time off. We help with the study aids. But there's the expectation that you're going to do it and you need to do it. And we have to constantly, in our yearly reviews and talking with the students, it's like remind them of those, you know, that commitment awaits you, you know, and go do that. Another thing that, you know, we as design professionals, they just graduated from School of Architecture. They're fully loaded, man. I mean, they are fully trained. You guys did your job. We cannot roll up to them and pretend like we have all of the answers. And now you need to listen, forget everything you learned and now listen to us, right? I mean, no. So what it means is that, you know, I had a young intern who was starting on a design exercise. And I'm looking at it and I, you know, it's like, and he sensed in me a little bit of bewilderment. I finally had to come right out and say, I don't know where you're heading with this, but I need to let you finish painting that picture out. Right. And, you know, give that person that space. Right. And they really appreciated it. And you know what? They did finish painting that picture out. And, you know, there were some new things in there that I had to look at. And it's like, you know, I didn't see that coming. I have to be open to what you can contribute to this process. And let's face it, you know, some days we're on fire just to get something done, to get this pulled together. I got a project on, you know, but you got to dampen down that, because if I roll up with too much anxiety and angst and you get, you know, it can smother them. You can run them over, right? And, you know, give them space. And also, you know, in this upcoming presentation, I have to create a void in that digital room for them to talk. But by same token, I got to tell them, look, I'm going to create a space for you to contribute. But, you know, you can't have dead air, dead silence for more than like 10 seconds, or they're going to run you over, right? So these are the things I want you to talk about. These are the things that you need to prepare to talk about. And I'll create that space, but, you know, don't wait too long to step into it. And it's amazing. You know, you do that over and over and over again. They realize, you know, it's a safe environment, you know, and they expect me to contribute, and I will. And I'm amazed at, you know, when they rise up to that moment. I was looking at one of the young interns from your school the other day. He had been with us in my strategy group now for almost 2 years. And, you know, I was looking at the man that had been in my group for 2 years with just such pride, you know, when he would share his thoughts. And, you know, he is the emerging face of humanity, you know. Listen to him.
Yeah. But Phil, I think the kind of space you're trying to create is so valuable. A lot of graduates, I mean, I would say right now is a great time to be graduating from architecture school. I mean, jobs are everywhere, opportunities everywhere. You know, beyond just the salary, you got options. They're everywhere. And I tell the students, listen, don't worry about that dollar right now. Who's offering you an extra $2 an hour, an extra $4,000, because listen, first of all, you're going to lose 25, third of it in taxes. So you're not going to get that extra 4,000 anyway. It goes down to three. And then when you spread it across 12 months, you know what? That's only going to be about another, you know, $200-$300 a week. So the question is, for that extra $50, do you want to go somewhere Monday where you don't want to be? So I think you're on track in terms of creating a space or place where people want to be. I think that's how you retain talent. You keep talent. You got people who put in their 40 hours plus without whining, but they're ready just to get stuff done because of this kind of the space and place you're trying to create for them, where, you know, I'm going to be reasonable. I'll be normal. I care about you. And together we can do great things. We're going to do great things together, and it'll be great for the company, and we'll all be happy. And, you know, we'll be proud of what we did. But I think that's the kind of thing that people can see in a conversation, in an interview or a casual conversation at a jury. And I think it's the kind of place recent graduates are looking for.
I want to pivot a little bit and go to some rapid fire questions to close out our podcast. So Andrew, what is the best advice you have ever received?
Find a mentor. You know, that helps you learn from other people's problems. other people's challenges and learn from other people's wins. And I think when you find a great mentor and listen to your mentor, you realize, you know, someone else knows more than you, and you learn to trust other people. So I'm appreciative of people who kind of told me that, and then that were my mentors in school and after school.
Philip?
I don't know. It's like the simplest advice I've gotten has carried me through my life. When I was a young man, I was like 12 years old. I got a job in a hardware store. And the owner of the store looked at me and goes, "Every person that walks in that door, I want you to walk up to them and ask them, how can I help?" And it's amazing that little piece of advice has carried me to where I am today.
And just the simplicity of both of those, sort of, it doesn't have to be complicated advice to be the best advice. It can just be simple, solid advice. Have someone who can help you, and then you can then return that help to someone else. And then just kindness and compassion for humanity, and creating a curiosity mindset, as you talked about before. I want to switch, and we do a lot at RSNH around mental health and wellness. And what is one thing, Andrew, that you do to support your own mental health and wellness?
My wife doesn't like to hear it, but for me, it's wash my car. Because, you know, she's like, "Oh, you need to take a walk, you need to hit golf ball." I mean, I love taking a walk. I love swinging a golf club. But you know what? It's almost like a well-done drawing. If I wash my car, I can see the mess beforehand. I can see a tangible outcome when it's done. And I feel like I've accomplished something. And you just look back and you go, okay, I'm taking care of my stuff. I finished something and I can see the difference in it. Because there's so much stuff we're involved in. It's a marathon. And you just see, you know, if I take a walk, I don't see the change in my stomach over, you know, in one walk. So that's what sometimes it's just like, wash the car, you know, or cut the grass. Those are two things I like. I look back and I go, I like the straight lines. I see it looks good.
Philip?
You know, we invest in things in our lives. We invest in our education. We invest in our 401ks. You know, invest in those significant others. You know, do not forsake them completely for a career goal. I made that mistake as a young man. And my wife said to me, you know, continue on your career path and you'll end up being inconsequential to others, your children and me. And that was a huge pivot. And so, you know, I realized the importance of investing in those significant others, my wife, my children, my daughters. So
one of the great things about hearing different individuals talk about their own mental health and awareness is just the fact that we're talking about it and sharing those ideas that then help you take a break, take two steps back. And when you see that dirty car, you get it into sparkling clean, and that puts you in a different mindset. And it sort of takes away maybe the rush of the day or the issue of the day. And I appreciate you giving us that, what may seem very simple on the one hand, but is absolutely, and you could tell to you, Andrew, and also to you, Philip, how that changes you in your mental health and wellness and well-being. And really appreciate you sharing that. One of the things about RSNH is our brand, we have an essence, and we call that driven to care. And that driven to care is in some respects the same for many of us in terms of what we do, but it's also very individual. And so when you hear driven to care, what do you think of, Andrew?
At Florida A&M, there's also a similar slogan, excellence with caring. I think it's a similar kind of balance that Phil talked about, that, you know, you can pursue, you can be driven, you can have excellence, but that doesn't mean you don't have caring. You don't have priorities, and it's, you know, it's not about stuff. It's about caring and having purpose. So when I hear Phil talk about kind of responsibilities and priorities, it's about recognizing your purpose, and the similar with the RSNH's statement.
And Phil, I know you live our essence all the time. Talk about what Driven to Care means to you.
We roll back to that responsibility, 1% representing 99%. You know, you really want to make sure the buildings we put on the face of this planet are not just merely the cheapest, fastest buildings on the face of the planet, but that it actually does, you know, respond to the context, to the culture of the individual. But in my team, you know, I mean, we have Jabber here. You get a little green dot when someone's online, you know, I see that name, I see that dot. I reach out to them. How you doing? What's up? You know, where you at? You know, it's just those constant questions and with sincerity, you know, how you doing, man? And they appreciate it. It's those reach out touch points.
You know, whether it's our own essence at RSNH is Driven to Care, or it's at your university, Florida A&M, where it's Excellence with Caring, that combination of caring, that taking a moment for a fellow human being, taking a moment for a student or a professional is what the industry is all about. We care about what we do, and we care about our clients, and we care about our colleagues. And I can't think of a better way than to end with talking about what we care about. So I just want to thank you, Andrew and Philip, for joining us on this edition of AEC Perspectives. It's been a great podcast. Appreciate your insights and appreciate all that you do to bring architects into our professional world to serve all of us in this beautiful country that we have in the way that you do. So thank you very much. Thank you for listening to this episode of AEC Perspectives. Follow or subscribe to AEC Perspectives wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And remember, at RSNH, we are driven to care.